welcome to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Seth Arnes.
And it is our pleasure to now introduce you to MIT professor and author Lorna Gibson. Professor Gibson, welcome to This Green Earth.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you have written a new book called Birds Up Close, which truly takes a microscopic look at birds. And I'm really excited to dive into those pages with you. But first, let's set the table a little bit about your background and what led you into writing this book. So tell us about your engineering background and how that became a great foundation for the study of birds.
Yeah, well, so I'm a professor in material science and engineering at MIT. And really, material science and engineering is all about looking at the microscopic structure of any material and then trying to say something about its properties and how it performs in some engineering application. So we call it structure-property relationships. And that's kind of the bread and butter of material science and engineering. And my research was on something totally different, nothing to do with birds, but it was on this structure-property relationships. And I'd written several academic books, which were really, you know, aimed at researchers. They were sort of very technical, you know, full of equations on every page. And when I finished writing the last one, I began to think I'd like to write something for a more general audience. And I thought that the thing I worked on for my research, I didn't think that many people would be interested in, but I'm a birder. And I thought maybe the birds might be a good vehicle for writing a book that had some kind of material science kind of approach. And for a general audience, for birders, really. It's really written for birders, not academics.
So your book, Birds Up Close, is broken down into chapters that break down everything from their feathers to their bone structure and bills. How did you gather all this intricate information?
Yeah, well, I started by just reading ornithology textbooks. You know, I don't have any background in ornithology as a science, really. I mean, I go out for a walk and look at the birds, but that's a different thing. So I started by just reading some ornithology textbooks, and there were all sorts of topics in them that I found interesting, and they didn't go into that much detail. And so I started reading the reference papers that the books referred to, and, you know, the reference scientific papers had a lot more detail in them. And I have to say, I found so many things about the birds that were just amazing. And the more I read about it, the more amazed I was. And it was a real pleasure. And I would, you know, I would go to MIT and I would say to my colleagues, you know, you're not going to believe what birds do. And I would tell them something I'd found out about birds. And they were like, wow, that's amazing. So it was a lot of fun doing it. But I really just did it by, you know, starting with ornithology textbooks and then reading journal papers. And then I also got to know a few ornithologists and I went to visit them and we talked about, you know, their work and that kind of stuff. And I should say, really, there's only one minor thing that's my research. Everything else is other people's research and other people's findings that were in the literature, but they were in the scientific literature. And I think your average birder wasn't aware of them. And so really what I've tried to do is explain things that other people had done that I thought were just amazing and interesting, and try to explain it in a way that birders could understand.
On that note, in the early part of your book, you talked about a National Geographic moment that you had at Jamaica Pond near Boston. And I think that was something about bald eagles hunting some coots as the ice was freezing up. And while that's a really, that's an image that really sticks with the reader, I was wondering what your Journal of Material Science moment was in kind of bringing together your love for ornithology and your academic background in material science. What was that aha moment?
Yeah, I think, you know, I started off on the feather chapters. That's what I started with. And I looked into what makes feathers iridescent. And the thing that makes them iridescent are these tiny little structures within the feathers that are less than a micron, you know, less than a thousandth of a millimeter. They're tiny little structures. And they're very, very precise, and they have to be precise to get the iridescent behavior. And when you see microscope pictures, you know, electron microscope pictures, these tiny little structures in the feathers, it's hard not to be awestruck. I mean, they're just incredible.
Yeah, break that down for us a little bit, what your learnings were around those feathers that you found so interesting.
So, you know, there's two chapters on feathers in the book. One's called Color and Sound, and the other one's called Warm and Dry. And all of those sort of responses of feathers have to do with their microscopic structure. So the bit on color looks at iridescence, for instance, and the iridescence in feathers works in a similar way to iridescence of, say, an oil patch, a sort of a skim of oil on a water puddle. And I'm not going to go into all the details. It's a little hard to describe it on the radio, not have visuals. But it works the same way as oil on water works. And I was very impressed with that. It turns out most of the color in bird feathers is from pigments, but there's no blue pigment. And blue is also a structural color. So blue arises from very tiny microscopic pores within the feather structure. And the pore size is such that the wavelength of light that interacts with it and reflects off and gives us the color that we see is blue. And longer wavelengths like reds and greens just go through these small pores and are absorbed by a melanin layer underneath them. And so there's these tiny little structures that give you blue. So when you look at something like a blue jay or a bluebird or a kingfisher, you know, they all have these tiny microscopic structures that produce the blue in the feathers. The feathers can also control sound. I was kind of surprised to read up on how much the feathers could control sound. So some feathers create sound. There's hummingbirds, especially male hummingbirds, that do courtship dives. So they'll do this dive in front of a female, and as they get to the bottom of the dive, there's sort of a U, and they come back up again. When they're right at the bottom of the dive, they separate their tail feathers, and their tail feathers vibrate a little like if you take a blade of grass and you put it between your thumbs and you blow on it, it makes that kind of squeezing sound, squealing sound. The feathers do the same thing. So the feathers can create sound, which I thought was interesting. They can also suppress sound. So, for instance, a lot of people know that owls fly almost silently, and that silent flight is produced by some special kind of unique structural features on the flight feathers of the owl wings. So the structure of the feathers can suppress the sound. The structure of feathers also collects sound. So if you think of an owl with a ruff, you know, on its facial ruff, the owls can hunt by hearing alone. And there's several different things that allow that to happen. One is that their ears are at different heights on the side of their heads, so that helps. But also the feathers in their ruffs are arranged in such a way that it helps them to hear. So if you think of the ruff as that sort of brownish heart-shaped thing on, say, a barn owl, the feathers inside of that are sort of more, the features of the feather, the vein is sort of more widely spaced, and so sound can transmit through that. And the ruff itself, that sort of heart-shaped brown ruff on the sort of front of the owl face, that has parts of the feather, the vein, that's very, very tightly packed together, and those are called reflector feathers, and they reflect the sound into the ears. And so some of the feathers allow the sound to transmit and some reflect the sound. And then on the left and the right side of the head, the feathers in the ruff are actually oriented in different directions. So that on one side, sounds from above sound louder in one ear, and on the other side, sounds from below sound louder in the other ear. And so it's really the structure of the feathers that helps with the great hearing that owls have and allows them to hunt by hearing alone.
I love your descriptors. It might be radio, but you are drawing such a beautiful picture of how this all works. So thank you for that.
So, you know, the other chapter on feathers is about warm and dry. So warm is how the down keeps a bird warm. So eiderdown, for example. And it works more or less the same way that an insulating foam works on a coffee cup or on, say, foams that are insulating buildings. The small pores in the foam help insulate, prevent heat from transmitting. And the down has structures in the feather that have a similar size to the pores in the foam. And it works in the same way as the foam. So it helps prevent conduction of the foam because there's a small volume fraction of the solid, and the air has a low thermal conductivity. So lots of air means you get more insulation. The cells are fairly small, and that inhibits convection. Like, you know, if you have a fire and the fire, you know, warm air rises and the cooler air drops, that gives you sort of a convection cycle. And if you have small cells, you get friction along the edge of the cells from the air moving past it. And that friction suppresses convection if the cells are small enough. And the same in the down. If the The sort of little porous structures in the down feathers are small enough that it suppresses convection. And then there's also radiation, and the small cells also help suppress radiation. So you can look at the structure of the down feathers and say something about how they insulate the bird and keep it warm. And then the other part of that chapter is on dry, so water repellency in feathers. Mm. You know, it's a common expression that water rolls off a duck's back. And you can actually see pictures of this where it does look like there's just a sheet of water, and it just slides right off the back of a duck. It doesn't really penetrate at all. And that, too, is related to the structure of the feathers. And there's a whole interesting story about that. So it turns out that during World War II, there were two scientists in England, and they worked at the Wool Industries Research Association, which just seems like an incredibly English kind of thing. And they were trying to make British wool uniforms more waterproof. So the British Army had all these, you know, wool coats, wool pants, wool everything, and they were trying to make them more waterproof. And they looked at the fibers in the wool, and in the wool, the fibers are all higgledy-piggledy. There's fibers this way and that way, and it's kind of geometrically messy to try and analyze. And so they thought what they would do is analyze something simpler. And that's kind of common in science and engineering. You pick a problem, it's kind of complicated, you try to simplify it somehow. And so they simplified it by saying, what would happen if we had a series of parallel rods, and all the rods are the same diameter and the same spacing apart? And then by thinking about how the water interacted with those rods, they could show that if you spaced the rods the right amount, you would increase the water repellency of this structure. And then they kind of said to themselves, even though they were kind of interested in wool clothing, they said, well, what has a structure that's parallel rods? And they said, duck feathers. So, you know, if you think of the vein of a duck feather, the vein is a series of parallel rods. Those are called barbs. And there's little branches off of those called barbules, and they're also parallel rods. And so they took some duck feathers and they measured the diameter of these barbs and barbules, and they measured the spacing, and they did a little calculation of what they thought the water repellency would be. And they found that indeed the duck feathers have remarkable water repellency. In fact, there's a sort of a measure of water repellency called the contact angle, and it reflects how much water beads up on a surface. So the more it beads up, the bigger that contact angle and the more water repellent a material is. And if a material has a contact angle over 140 degrees, engineers call that super hydrophobic. And the duck feathers were indeed super hydrophobic. And there's some really nice photographs in the literature, and my students also took some photographs as well. And you can just see, if you put a drop of water on a goose feather or a duck feather, it beads right up into this little kind of spherical ball.
Yeah.
And that's the water repellency of the feathers.
So you're talking about an engineering application of the water repellency of bird feathers. I was wondering, what else can we learn from the bird's perspective and take that into the engineering and materials science world? What other lessons have you gleaned from this work that can be applied?
Well, I guess just to kind of take the water repellency thing one step further, Cassie and Baxter, the two guys at the Wool Institute, they never applied their stuff to clothing.
No.
But today that is applied to clothing. So if you go buy a raincoat at an outdoor, you know, supply store, it'll have something called a durable water repellent, a DWR coating on it. And that coating is based on the structure of a lotus leaf. It's sort of parallel posts that are sticking up vertically from a surface. So the geometry of it is slightly different than the duck feathers. You know, it's sort of posts sticking up instead of horizontal rods in a plane. But it's analyzed exactly the same way, and you use the same Cassie Baxter approach. And the raincoats today basically use what Cassie and Baxter figured out for duck feathers to make those raincoats water repellent. Another example that I mentioned in the book is this idea of the silent flight of the owls. You know, the owls want to fly silently for two reasons, because they hunt by hearing, so they don't want to have a lot of noise interfering with their own hearing, but also they don't want their prey to hear them approaching, so they want to be silent for that too. And one of the things the owl feathers have is the leading edge of the wing, the feather at the very leading edge of the wing, has a series of serrations on it. And it's been found that that helps to reduce the amount of noise from the flight. And there's one of the companies that makes wind turbine blades that now has a wind turbine blade that they've made a sort of serrated leading edge on it to try to reduce the noise from the wind turbine blade. And that's based on the owl feathers.
It is fascinating how we can derive so much from the natural world and then pull it into our sciences and see ways in which we can put that into what we're engineering. When you were writing this book and you said your audience you thought was basically a birder or someone who maybe had this intimate relationship with birds but maybe didn't know their structure, what are some of the big takeaways that you want these birders to derive from your book?
Well, I think a lot of people get into birding because the birds are so beautiful. They're so colorful. They fly. I mean, how can you not be in awe of something that flies the way a bird can fly? You know, hummingbirds can fly backwards. It's really astonishing what birds can do. So I think a lot of people who are interested in birds, you know, see them from the outside. They see the feathers and they try to identify the species, and it's a lot of fun doing that. But I wanted people to see that there was more to the birds than that, and that they were just as amazing if you looked at these microscopic structures within the birds.
So let's turn the lens now on their bone structures. Can we talk about that?
Sure. So the bones are fairly lightweight, and there's a couple of different types of structures in the bones that you can see. So some of the bones, like the long bones, say in a wing or a leg, they're hollow tubes. And if you compare the similar bones in a mammal, so, you know, the leg or the arm bones, they're also tubes. They have marrow in the middle, but they're tubes. And the bird wings have a lower thickness relative to their diameter than the mammal bones do. And you can show, doing some engineering analysis, and I don't get into the details in the book, but you can show that the smaller thickness to diameter ratio in the bird bones allows them to be lighter for a given stiffness or a given strength. So that's one of the ways they reduce their weight, is by having these thinner walled bones. Another structure that you see in bird bones, and you see this in mammals too, but in the bird bones, it's remarkably delicate. So there's something called sandwich structures in engineering. So for instance, if you get a box from a delivery and it's got this cardboard box, and if you look at it carefully, there's sort of two pieces of cardboard on the top and the bottom, and there's often a little waffly thing in the middle. And that is a sandwich structure. So it just means it's a sandwich because there's solid faces and then there's some sort of porous core. And those sandwich structures work mechanically the same way an I-beam does. So if you walk past a construction site of a skyscraper or something like that, for instance, often the frame is made of steel I-beams. And that's because if you take a beam and you bend it, you get most of the deformation is either at the top of the beam or the bottom of the beam. If you take the beam and you bend it, it'll have, say, compression at the top, and it'll have tension at the bottom. So it's pushing the top together and pulling the bottom apart. And so the stresses or the forces inside the beam are the biggest at the top and the bottom. And that's why an I-beam is the shape that it is that you want to put most of the material at the top and the bottom to resist those forces. And the sandwich panels work the same way. You put most of the solid material at the top and the bottom, and then you've got some sort of waffle or honeycomb or some sort of foam, some sort of lightweight core to separate them. So the bird bones, some of the bird bones are sandwich panels. So if you look at a skull, parts of the skull have that sandwich structure. If you look at things like the hip bones or the sternum, the sort of breastbone of the bird, they all have this sandwich structure. And the thing that's remarkable about it is just the scale of it. So we took microcomputed tomography images. I have a colleague at Harvard, and one of his students, L. Fon Lai, took the micro CT images for us. And one of the things that's amazing is the bones themselves are fairly thin. There might be 1 or 2 millimeters thick. And then the faces are even thinner than that. And the little struts separating the faces are really tiny. And they're really it's really remarkable just to see how delicate these structures are, and that, you know, these sandwich structures allow the birds to have fairly lightweight bones, which helps, you know, reduce their weight for flight.
One question I have is to make a little bit of a pun on the what comes first, the chicken or the egg question. What's come first, our understanding of birds or our understanding of engineering? And I was wondering if you could give an example of both sides of things, that we learned something from engineering and then saw in birds, and then we learned something from birds and applied it to engineering.
Let's see. I mean, the sandwich structure appears in other things in nature. And I think it existed, well, obviously it existed in nature. And I think people understood how that worked. Like, engineers and scientists figured out how beams work. They figured out how I-beams worked. They developed sandwich structures, really in World War II, for mosquito planes to make the planes lightweight. But I don't think they were really modeling it on these natural structures. I think they were sort of finding it independently. And then we look at the natural structures and see that they have this same kind of sandwich structure. And even some plants have a sandwich structure. If you look at a cattail leaf or an iris leaf, those are sandwich structures too. So I think that's an example of engineering, or engineers sort of developing a theory and developing models and figuring out how something works, and then kind of seeing it in nature, in the bird bones or in, you know, something else. And I guess, for an example, the other way around would be the owl silent flight. You know, the idea that the owl has these serrations at the leading edge of the wing, and people have mimicked that in the wind turbine blades. And other engineers have done tests on airfoils that also mimic the owl wings. The owl wings have these serrations at the leading edge, but they also have what's called a velvety surface on the feathers on the wings. And what that is, if you look at a feather, there's the shaft, and then the vane is made up of barbs that come off. That's what you can see with your eye, the sort of parallel barbs. And then there's another branching called barbules that come off the barb shafts. And on an owl wing, those barbules are very, very long, and they kind of stick up vertically out of the plane of the wing. And that also is thought to help reduce the noise generated by the wing. And engineers have tried to make materials that have that kind of a structure, and they've put them on airfoils in wind tunnels, and they find that the noise is reduced as the wind goes over the, or as the air goes over the airfoil. I don't know that they've ever used that on a wind turbine blade or something like that, but the idea is sort of to mimic what the birds are doing and try to develop an engineering design that's similar.
So getting back to how the book was built out, you have all these photos and very detailed illustrations on everything from those barb shafts that you were just mentioning. Why was it important for you to include all those visuals?
I think the visuals are really important. And I say in the preface, you know, I teach engineering, and I could not teach my engineering classes without sketches and diagrams and photographs of the microscopic structure of materials. People don't think of engineering as a visual thing, but it is. It would be very hard to do engineering without a lot of visuals, and at least the type of engineering I do. And so I thought it was important to include in the book. And I did want to mention also the electron micrographs of the feathers were taken by an undergraduate student, Isaac Cabrera. And he did a fantastic job. I mean, those are beautiful images. I think also, you know, even if you just flip through the book, it's very highly illustrated. It's in color. There's lots of photographs of birds. There's lots of electron microscope images, computed tomography images. I think it's just a pleasure to flip through it and look at the images, even if you didn't kind of read it, just to look at the images and to read the captions and see these things that are inside birds.
We talked about you truly making this a microscopic book. So you get into the finest of details about these winged creatures. And I find that really fascinating. And also to the layperson, it allows us to take a deeper dive and to have a greater understanding of why it is we are so fascinated by birds, from color to structure to how they operate in the world and their flight. So I think it is a really well laid out book, and I appreciate you putting it in that way.
Well, thanks so much for your kind words. It was a real pleasure to work on the book and to write it. I do a lot of talks on it. I've been doing talks since I started writing it. And people just love it. I mean, I think part of it is they've never seen birds that way. They've never looked at birds that way. And it's a new way of, I mean, it's not, obviously this isn't in the research literature. It's not new to the world, but I think for a lot of birders, it's new to them. And I think they get very fascinated by it.
The book is called Birds Up Close, and we have been talking with MIT professor Lorna Gibson. And the book comes out today, May 5th. If people wanted to learn more about you and this book, is there a website or place they can go to?
Birdsupclose.org.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate you so much for being a part of This Green Earth today. Again, the book is called Birds Up Close. You can check it out at birdsupclose.org.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation to speak to your listeners.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth.
If you have an idea, we'd love to hear from you. Give us your ideas and topics, your storylines. It's thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
You can also find us wherever you listen to your podcast. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review. And we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.